Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the seventh night and this is the final stream of the seventh night. And this is with Jared Taylor, who's one of the most hotly anticipated guests. And let me just wait a while just to see if this is working, because we just tried it and for some reason it didn't come through. So I'm just waiting to see what's going on here. What? Ah, there we go. Now we're showing. All right, excellent. It's working now. So this is one of the most hotly anticipated guests, Jared Taylor of Amren, American Renaissance. So thank you very much for appearing, Jared. I don't think we need to go into any big introductions for you and a guest as illustrious as yourself.
Oh, heavens. No, thanks very much for inviting me. For those who are unfamiliar with me, the best way to find out is to go to our website, amren.com, and you'll find out more about me than you would ever wish to know.
All right. And that will be linked below once this is on BitChute. So, okay, there have been three major issues this year. COVID, the US election, and BLM. And the other two have been talked about on Millennial, but BLM has not really been explored. It's been mentioned here and there, but it hasn't been gone into in any depth. So that's what you and I are going to do in this stream. So let's talk briefly about the history of BLM. I think it began in 2013 after the Trayvon Martin killing, self-defense killing. So would you like to go into that?
Well, certainly. Of course, BLM stands for Black Lives Matter. As if in the United States, of course, the idea is Black lives have never mattered. And so to say that Black Lives Matter is a radical expression of some kind of newly discovered truth that upends the whole vision of American history, that seems to be the stance that BLM takes. But yes, it started essentially in the year after the killing of Trayvon Martin, 2012, after the facts went to trial. George Zimmerman, this Hispanic, who is nevertheless described as white by the media, was characterized as this wicked racist man who tracked down an unoffending young black man and shot him to death in cold blood. Well, as still is the case in the United States, if a criminal trial goes before a jury, both sides worked very hard to bring the facts out, of course, in the way that is to the advantage of their client. But you still can get a pretty fair criminal trial in the United States. And you're innocent until proven guilty, and the system is definitely set up to make that possible. And if you are defending someone who's accused of a capital crime, then there are many important parts of the legal machinery that compel people to come forward with evidence in your favor if you have any idea that it exists. So, as it turned out, George Zimmerman got a fair trial, and the jury discovered what really happened, namely that he had not tracked someone down in cold blood, that he, in fact, himself had been attacked by this young black man, knocked down, was being pounded, and in desperation, in an act of legitimate self-defense, he unholstered his legally registered and legally owned firearm and fired one round, killing his attacker. Now, this was considered by blacks and by many hopped up whites a gross miscarriage of justice. This was yet another proof that black lives do not matter. And so a number of women, the most prominent of whom is named Patrice Cullors, C-O-L-L-O-R-S, they started this Black Lives Matter movement. Now, it is surprisingly a feminist and lesbian. They seem to be just as excited about transsexual rights and lesbian rights as any other kinds of rights, and they describe themselves as trained Marxists. Now, these days, the word Marxist simply means, as far as I can tell, someone who has a deep hatred for existing American society. If you asked Patrice Cullors to explain labor theory of value or dialectic materialism, or whether or not the proletariat is likely to seize the means of production, she'd probably think you were speaking Greek. But she claims to be a trained Marxist. In any case, this movement bubbled along for the most part, on college campuses, and there would be occasional Black Lives Matter demonstrations after nearly every legitimate police killing of a Black man. These things are rare enough so that everyone gets a huge amount of media attention, even under those circumstances in which the Black person is opened fire at the police. They have to kill him in obvious self-defense. Still, every act of this kind just comes under the microscope. And so these BLM people would go marching through the streets of any major metropolis, some of them talking about referring to the police as pigs, pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon. Pigs in a blanket, by the way, is a popular food for children in the United States. So pigs in a blanket, pig being the police, fry them like bacon, death to the police, et cetera, this kind of thing. In any case, then in the Ferguson riots in 2014, this also was one of the rallying cries, Black Matters. This had to do with the death of Michael Brown. Now, in the United States, if you commit a crime and the police come your way and you attack a police officer, try to wrestle his gun out of his hand, you're likely to come to a sticky end. And that's the kind of sticky end that Michael Brown came to. But because he was Black, the police officer was white. Once again, this became very much a cause for Black Lives Matter. Well, and the Baltimore riots, every time there was any kind of Black misbehavior, then the theme was Black Lives Matter. And it got to the point in the United States where if you were to say, well, don't all lives matter? No, you were then a racist and a white supremacist, and you were propping up the white patriarchy to even dare to think in terms of all lives matter. But there was a dramatic change in all of this on Labor Day weekend, the end of May of this year, when George
Floyd... Just before we go into this, you said... that before we went on air, you said that this year has seen a real change in American attitudes to race because of what we're about to describe. So you think that this year has been extremely significant in the development of race relations, race conceptions in America. So let's say something about that just before we go into what happened.
This was I think that the Black Lives Matter, the manner in which it took flight and entered into American imagination and discourse this year, is the most important thing that happened this year. Ultimately, more important even than COVID or the election of Donald Trump. Perhaps it, competes with COVID in terms of its long-term significance, assuming that it has set off something that is not diverted or completely defeated by subsequent events. And let me explain to you why. Until George Floyd died at the hands of the police in Minneapolis, and George Floyd is probably someone whose name is known by virtually every living person on the planet today.
Say his name.
There is a great deal of evidence to suggest that he died essentially of a drug overdose that was complicated by the excitement of being arrested. I won't go into the details of why it is, I think, absolutely incorrect to consider this a murder. But again, all of this will come out at trial. I still have a very considerable faith in American jury trials, especially in a criminal case. And I would not be surprised if the officer whose neck was famously on George Floyd's, I'm sorry, whose knee was on George Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 56 seconds, it would not astonish me if he's acquitted. He will certainly not be convicted of murder. Maybe some sort of negligence, but certainly not of murder. But that is something for a future juror, for future jury to decide. The assumption about this was that this was an act of naked and reprehensible racism. Whereas, of course, the idea of a white policeman with a gang of Blacks around him taunting him deliberately before their very eyes, killing a Black man, the idea that a white person would do this is absolutely preposterous. Every white police officer in the country knows that not only can he be out of a job, he can be disgraced, he can be a front page story if in a split second he does the wrong thing if he is face to face with a Black person. Every police officer knows this. A police officer's job, I think, in America, certainly in a big city full of Black people, is perhaps the most difficult and most thankless in the world. In any case, What then happened?
Let's go back to the chronology now and say what happened. What started all this year?
Well, after George Floyd died, and this video of him with a white police officer's knee on his neck went all the way around the world many, 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 many times. Of course, what happened is Minneapolis erupted in riots. We had the worst riots since the 1960s, really quite astonishing riots. And more than 300 cities in the United States had to have curfews because the rioting was so severe. The National Guard was called out in 30 states to help maintain the peace. This was an extraordinary series of looting, arson, attacks on the police. And there are some cities in the United States, Portland and Seattle to begin with, that where you still have episodic violence of this kind. Now, what is particularly significant about this is that whenever there have been race riots in the past, certainly the race riots of the 1960s, certainly the famous ones, Watts riot in Los Angeles, Newark, Detroit, Washington, D.C., practically without exception, the rioters were black and they were rioting in their own neighborhoods. What was dramatically different about this series of riots was, first of all, there was a significant amount of white participation. White people rioting, some of them because they're just anarchists and want an opportunity to loot and burn and try to injure as many police officers as possible. But there was a not inconsiderable number of at least white demonstrators who, unlike in the past, genuinely seem to believe that black failure is something for which they are personally responsible. This is a new phenomenon in American racial thinking. The number of white people who will subscribe to idiotic slogans such as white silence is violence. In other words, if white people are simply doing nothing, minding their own business, in fact, in their personal lives, trying to be as fair as possible to people, no matter what the color of their skin, this is doing violence to blacks. A completely topsy-turvy view of racial morality in which unless white people are actively, perpetually, daily atoning for white guilt, trying to undermine white supremacy, whatever that is, wherever that's to be found, then they are participating in violence against blacks. Absolutely cuckoo thinking, quasi-religious thinking. There are many whites who have fallen for this. This is a brand new phenomenon. Something else that is brand new. The companies whose stores were looted and burned to the ground, Target being one of the prime examples. Target is headquartered in Minneapolis, one of the first enormous stores that was utterly sacked was the Target in Minneapolis. What has the Target company done? First of all, it has set aside hundreds of millions of dollars to give to the Black Lives Matter movement. It has also rebuilt this particular Target store from the ground up. It hired a Somali-owned design firm to design it in ways to make it particularly and aggressively attractive to blacks. They had sessions within the community to find out exactly what black people wanted in their Target, and they were going to build this brand new Target to make blacks as happy as possible. So they are rewarding blacks for having burned down the Target. And Target and the Target company is not alone. At last count, the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States has received, you may hold your breath, and here's a drum roll, over $10 billion. Now, just to give you an idea of what this figure means, the Ford Foundation, one of the largest, most prestigious charities in all of the United States, has an endowment of $12 billion. Black Lives Matter has 10. The Ford Foundation has hundreds of people who are trying very carefully to use their money, for the most part, I think, in destructive ways. But they've got this whole staff of folks who keep tabs of the money and make sure that it doesn't end up being beefsteaks for the boys, Gucci handbags for the girls. All of a sudden, this utterly untrained, untutored Patrice Couleur, who describes herself as a trained Marxist, she's now decided, by the way, that the Black Lives Matter has been excessively decentralized. Now that it's got billions of dollars at its disposal, it's got to be centralized. And miraculously and coincidentally, it should be centralized under her authority. So here you have this wacko lesbian trained Marxist, so-called, who's now sitting on $10 billion. Now this is something, again, utterly, utterly without precedent in American race relations history, that when you have some people, somebody burns down your town, you reward them. You reward them by giving them not just hundreds, not just thousands, not just millions, billions of dollars. Something else that's utterly unprecedented. You may be aware of the hundreds of statues that have been destroyed in the United States. Now, it used to be that Confederates were the prime targets. Throughout the South, there have been hundreds of statues of Confederate soldiers, Confederate seamen. These have been coming down year after year after year. In many places, they were torn down violently by mobs. In other places, the authorities took them down before the mobs could get to them. But it wasn't just Confederates. There were at least 30 statues of Columbus that came down in this process. There were statues of George Washington, statues of Thomas Jefferson. There were statues in the western part of the United States of the pioneer mother, the pioneer father. This is in the state of Washington. These had to come down because they were white people. They showed up in what were sacred Indian territory, and the fact that they were white, and the fact they brought white civilization, this makes them targets. Now, the idea in 1968, when blacks were rioting in Watts or in Newark, the idea that we were to appease these rioters by tearing down statues of Columbus, that would have occurred to no one, absolutely no one. This is a brand new form of self-loathing and insanity on the part of white people. Again, as I say, this is a hugely significant development in the history of race relations. And we've gotten to the point now where you cannot practically take a breath in the United States without being obliged to think in terms of whether or not your inhalation or your exhalation is anti-racist or racist. Every action in America is now put under this microscope to determine whether it is doing wonderful things for blacks or whether it's oppressing them brutally. It's got to be one or the other. There's no such thing as neutrality. And now any white person who wishes to just live his life being kind to everyone, that is colorblind racism. White people we can't do anything right. Nothing we can do is possibly right. And just the latest thing that's happened in my state of Virginia, as you and some of your viewers may know, in the United States Capitol, there's something called the National Statuary Hall. It is in a really quite beautiful crypt beneath the Capitol building, and every state has two statues that represent the people that are considered that state's heroes. Well, today, one of the statues that represents the state of Virginia came down. And that was a statue of General Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee was a genuinely great man. He has been adored and admired by Southerners and by Yankees up until perhaps 30 or 40 years ago. General Eisenhower, who was certainly not a Southerner, he was a Yankee. He kept a portrait of Robert E. Lee in his White House office because he so admired Robert E. Lee's personal qualities, his bravery, his integrity, his gentlemanliness. He was a genuinely great man. Well, because he was a Confederate, and so he fought for the Confederacy, that means whether or not he owned slaves, he was a wicked oppressor of the people who are now the most important people in America, namely the folks who are supposed to always refer to as African Americans. Because he fought for the Confederacy, he's got to go. His statue is coming down. Now, with whom will they replace him? As you probably know, if a racist white man comes down from any position of authority or admiration, he's never replaced with a non-racist white man. Apparently, such people don't exist. So, because when Robert E. Lee comes down, you don't replace him with Patrick Henry, another great Virginian, certainly not James Madison, certainly not James Monroe, certainly not Admiral Byrd, the polar explorer. No, none of these people. They were never, ever, ever even in the running. Of course, the statue that would replace Robert E. Lee has to be that of a black female. In this case, a black 16-year-old. A black 16-year-old no one has ever heard of. Her name is Barbara Johns. What the heck did she do? In 1951, she started a brief student strike at her segregated school in Virginia because she thought the facilities were poor. This case was later taken up by the NAACP and rolled into a combination of lawsuits that went to the Supreme Court, which eventually resulted in Brown versus Board, which made segregated schools illegal. So she started a student strike when she was 16 years old. After that, as far as history is concerned, her life is a complete blank. She did one thing on one day, and now she is a civil rights icon, and her statue will go up in Statuary Hall. Now, just a little quiz for your listeners and viewers, and then I will shut up for a while. I've been babbling insanely, but as you can see, I'm pretty worked up about this whole Black Lives Matter business. This is the absurdity to which it concludes. The other person, just for your information, who represents Virginia in the National Statuary Hall, happens to be another dead white man, George Washington. So now we have George Washington, and we have this utter non-entity who at age 16 did one thing for one day and has then gone into eternal stardom, but who did nothing else the rest of her life. Her greatest achievement after that point was to be a librarian in an elementary school. But so she and the father of the country are going to be cheek by jowl, shoulder to shoulder in Statuary Hall. Now, my assumption is that they will be so obviously ill-assorted a pair that they're going to eventually have to get rid of that white supremacist warmonger and slave driver, George Washington. And who replace him with, I don't know, but I'm sure it'll be another black person. And anyway, I think I have given you my impression of the significance of this Black Lives Matter movement, the extent to which it has absolutely captured elite imagination, elite consciousness, so that everything, absolutely every bit of every part of the curriculum in public school, private school, grade school, kindergarten, university, has got to be rejigged, remodeled to the benefit of blacks, and of course, to portray whites in the most pathetic and oppressive light. So let me pause for a moment for you to comment or ask a question. Are you having any input from the audience, or are we to just carry on?
We'll just right. carry on for now, but people are welcome to post questions on entropy, and we will ask those at the end. I'll just paste that link again into the DLive chat. And I suppose, I mean, there are so many questions, and there are so many. I didn't want to interrupt you because you were in full storytelling mode there, and you were yes. telling a very good yarn. So I didn't want to interrupt that. But there are so many questions.
Yes, please.
Obvious main one would be, what is it that makes white people vulnerable to this kind of thing? Because I think, as you said before we went on air, the numbers, you can tell them about the... I mean, I remember actually talking to a libertarian once, and he said to me, I can't understand how I can't interest people in libertarianism. You can tell people about the benefits that they can be independent and stand on their own 2 feet, and they're just not interested. And in the same, because of course he's missing something about human nature. Yeah. And in the same way, I think to rely wholly on statistics and to say, well, to tell middle of the road and left wing white people, well, you know, black people actually aren't treated that badly. Here are the statistics on arrests and killing during arrests and so on. A lot of them simply aren't interested. They'll find some way around that. They'll say, oh, you're just trying to confuse me, or you're just lying, or, yeah, where did you get those numbers from, and so on. And so I think it really bypasses people's rational faculties. They're not open to the idea that black people are actually being treated fine in America, or indeed in Britain, or any other country. They, at this point, want it to be the case. And I'm talking about white people, like ordinary white people. Want it to be the case that black people, that their group is abusing on a mass scale this other group, black people. What makes that happen?
I wish I knew.
Because it's obviously not rationality. Because
I have been cudgeling my brains for more than 30 years to try to understand what it is about white people that makes them try to feel so good about feeling so bad about being white. What is it that thrills white people to think that their co-racialists are terrible people? Now, it used to be that when white people would denounce white people, they were clearly talking about other people. Those police officers, those rubes in flyover country, those horrible gas station attendants, you know, who actually own guns and don't really want to be around black people. Nowadays, though, some of the most highly paid anti-racist gurus will tell you that white liberals are some of the most dangerous people to blacks. So no white person is exempt. This is a church of perpetual guilt, eternal damnation, which there's no salvation. All of the gurus will tell you that attempting to become anti-racist, all you can do is try. No white person can ever succeed in being truly anti-racist. This is a lifelong journey. They always call it a journey. But it's a journey, apparently, in bare feet over icy ground, because it's going to be painful all the way. So you ask me, why? Why do white people behave this way? I cannot say. Most people, even ordinary healthy people, are generally looking for ways to feel positive about their group. Most healthy people, in fact, I can't think of any healthy people, only unhealthy people, are desperately looking for reasons to call into question the achievements of their group, the history of their group, to convince themselves that everything that their people have ever done is reprehensible and wicked. This, to me, is without precedent in the history of the world. White people are turning upon themselves in this suicidal frenzy that I cannot explain. Now, I could go into a long-winded story about some of the aspects of whites that I think make them unique compared to other races, which leaves them vulnerable to a kind of assault in which they become victims of their own virtues. There is a kind of altruism about whites which can be turned against them. But all of this is theorizing to me, and none of this kind of behavior can be biologically adaptive. Any group that behaves this way will go extinct. And if white people continue to behave in this Black Lives Matter form of insanity, if that is not cured, then white people just don't deserve to survive.
I agree that this is something which is maladaptive for sure, but I don't think it would have been possible to behave like this in an age when people actually had to worry about dying out. And ironically, we do have to worry about dying out, but in an age when death was much more close to people's daily lives, I think that, and you know, they had to work hard in order to survive. I think in that context, you simply wouldn't be thinking in these terms of, well, how can we damage ourselves? How can we weaken ourselves for the sake of some other group?
Yes.
That would be a patently ridiculous thought to have in such a context. So I do think that the luxury that we live with now really makes us amenable to this, to this thing. But I think the thing itself is an aspect of our character. I think it's a desire for justice, which has been completely subverted.
Yes. Well, you can go all the way back to the Roman satirist Juvenal. He said that luxury is more ruthless than war. And he was talking about even in Roman times, when there was peace, when there was luxury, then all of these strange, debauched habits begin to enter the population, and it destroys them in a way that not even war can destroy. And we are certainly being destroyed in that sense today. It is true that when you think of all of the hallmarks of Western civilization, they are based on a kind of fair-mindedness. One man, one vote. The idea that, okay, I may be a whole lot stronger and tougher and richer and more powerful than you, but your vote is going to be worth as much as my vote? This is a revolutionary concept, but this is the way Westerners, white people, think. Or the idea of the rule of law. I may be rougher and tougher than you, but I'm subject to the same law. I may be highborn, you're a serf, but still the same law applies to all of us. None of this makes sense in an Oriental context. The idea also of women's rights. This too is something utterly alien to most societies. Women are property. Women are to be used by men. But we put women on a pedestal. This too is unique. It's all this sense of others having rights that we must respect. And we carry this even to the rights of other species. Only whites came up with this idea of saving the whales. The Japanese, they're rich as we are, they'd rather eat the whales. The idea of preserving the planet for future generations, all of this is very, very Western-oriented. And so this idea of recognizing the rights not only of other people, of other sexes, of other species, of generations unborn for whom we must maintain a healthy planet, all of this made us very, very easily exploited by people who say, well, gosh, you all are so much better off than these people over here. Don't they deserve rights too? And of course, the immediate reaction of white people is, oh my gosh, maybe they are poor because we are rich. Maybe we are rich because they are poor. This doesn't follow at all, but there is something about white people that makes them susceptible because of this, and as you suggested, this fundamental fair-mindedness with which whites have, over the centuries, built up a certain kind of society that takes this kind of equal rights, fair-mindedness, concern for the fate of others to a remarkable degree, which I think can be useful within the tribe. But once that sentiment is diverted outside the tribe, it becomes ultimately suicidal.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that one thing that we were saying before we went on air is that this also seems to have, it's not just a moral thing. It's not just, well, I want to be a good person and, well, it looks like this is what I've got to do to be a good person. There's a zest about this self-flagellation, which is, and especially now, I think it is quite unprecedented. And I think that it does seem significant that this is all happening in the absence, in an age which doesn't have religion as such. Yes, we're still living in Christian society, but they're post-Christian. I mean, and it's being discredited and replaced, demolished everywhere. Yeah. So I really think it is a substitute for religion.
Yes, it is. But why would this religion be one of, as I say, one in which salvation is impossible? What kind of religion is that? Usually, religion brings some kind of hope. Religion, it gives you a model to live a better life. This only tells you that the best you can hope for is to be less wicked, a little bit less wicked. It's an extraordinary thing to me. Another aspect, though, that I think is certainly worth considering is the demoralizing effect of two world wars. When you read the literature after the Great War, after the First World War, there was a real sense that something must be wrong with Western man, with European man, to have unleashed this catastrophe on itself. And then, 19 years later? 21 years later, the same damn thing happens all over again. There was something very, very deeply demoralizing about this. And that, too, adds, I believe, to a kind of doubt, very fundamental doubt about the legitimacy of white people. That, too, has gnawed at our brains. And as far as Christianity is concerned, it's certainly true that Christianity is a very, very meek religion. Turn the other cheek, blessed are the poor, all of these things. And the Good Samaritan. The Samaritan was an illegal alien by today's standards, and you have to go be nice to this illegal alien who is in distress. All of these aspects make us particularly vulnerable. But still, what we're doing goes against so many fundamental biological urges that it is still a mystery to me. As I say, I have been trying to get to the bottom of this for decades now, and all I have is a whole set of somewhat peripheral explanations. There are people who say that Jews have been at the base of undermining any sense of white racial consciousness or legitimacy. And it's certainly true that I think Jews have been overrepresented in the movements that have tried to delegitimize any kind of nationalist or healthy racial thinking. But none of these is a sufficient explanation in my mind. There's something, even if you take them all together, there is nothing that explains something so contrary to human nature, contrary to common sense, contrary to just the most basic steps for group survival.
Well, I mean, it's possible that we, at some level, we want to destroy ourselves. We want destruction. We want oblivion. That's one of the possibilities.
Well, you know, there is, as I said before, in earlier phases of this white man taking up the black man's burden and castigating his fellow white man, there was a sense of moral superiority. And I read a fascinating book on the subject of pathological altruism. And I learned something that I think is very important about explaining the mentality of these utterly, utterly hopped up liberals. And that is a feeling of righteous indignation. It stimulates the same pleasure centers of the brain that addictive drugs do. This feeling of being morally superior to others can be actually addictive. And if you convince yourself that your whole society is full of wretched people who are suppressing others, and that you have seen through this, the sense of virtue and righteous indignation is something that people get so used to and so intoxicated by that they can't live without it. But then again, as I said before, increasingly, even those who are pointing out the sins of their fellow whites, they themselves have to confess that they are just as guilty.
Well, yes. And that might link with one of the super chats that's come in. Virtue signaling can also be seen as resource signaling. It's a sign of comfort and excess. Its prevalence is indicative of an unprecedented wealth. Yeah. I have a feeling it is about to become much less affordable for most whites.
It's certainly not affordable for a lot of whites. You tell these people who got a high school education, they're working two jobs, trying to put their children through college for the first time. And Jennifer comes home after a semester at the state university and starts castigating daddy about upholding the white patriarchy and his white privilege. Good Lord, what a way to be paid back for working your knuckles to the bone, trying to make a better life for your children. But white people are not going to be able to afford this. No society can afford this kind of absolute obsession with trying to bring about a form of equality, which is impossible. And this brings me to another aspect of this, and that is all of the differences in achievement in American society are assumed to be the work of racism. If blacks are poorer, they're more likely to be in jail, more likely to get their girlfriends pregnant. All of this is somehow the fault of wicked white people. The idea that blacks might not have the same average IQ as whites, this is absolute there be dragons forbidden territory. And yet, if we are unable to talk about racial differences in motivation or ability to defer gratification, racial differences in average IQ, then every single one of these differences is laid at our feet. We become the guilty ones. As far as the whole business of virtue signaling, it has become a very interesting thing watching how Asians, how they try to enter the upper reaches of American society. As I'm sure you and your listeners know, Asians on average have higher incomes than whites and more likely to go to Ivy League schools, lower crime rates, by all sorts of objective standards. They're doing very well in this allegedly white supremacist society that somehow doesn't manage to suppress blacks. But they have now decided that part of the entrance ticket to elite society is to have elite views, luxury opinions. And these luxury opinions have to do with the wretched and oppressive nature of American society. The idea that blacks need and deserve special preferences and affirmative action. more and more you'll find Asians thinking that in order to really be accepted, not just have the money, not just have the education, but to be part of the elite, they have to think just like the people who write editorials for the New York Times, this form of virtue signaling, if you will. People now talk about luxury beliefs. Facts don't matter, but this is what you have to think in order to be one of the beautiful people, one of the virtuous people, one of the people who America looks up to, or at least has a possibility of ruling rubes like me who don't understand how the world really works.
Well, yes, and I've seen this other also with other ethnicities in Britain, where they take on, you know, they're obviously trying to be westernized, they're trying to adopt the latest idea, like the best, the coolest version of being Western. So it's not Victorian attitudes or even 60s attitudes. It's how can I, basically, I've got to hate white people.
Yes.
The very society that I've come to, I've got to disparage and despise.
That's right.
And denigrate.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. But as you point out, and as people who've been talking about Asians will point out, you are rewarded for this. I'm really annoyed by the number of subcontinental Indians who come to this country. And many of them are smart enough to have figured it all out very, very quickly. And they start lecturing people like me on what America stands for and what America requires, how to be on the right side of history. The fact that my ancestors fought in the revolution against Great Britain. They fought in every war. This continent is drenched with their blood and stuffed with their bones. But somehow, some uppity wog shows up and tells me what America is about. That's just the utter arrogance of this. There's something about the number of Indians who have taken this attitude that really gets under my skin. Blacks, we at least dragged over here against their will, and they have some sort of legitimate gripe. But these people who show up voluntarily, and they really do seem to act as though we were about to choke to death on our own fatal homogeneity until they showed up with this precious gift of diversity that we should be on our knees kissing their feet for saving us from this horrible, horrible dung heap that we turned this place into. Thanks to them, it's a place worth coming to now.
I think that we should just simply say, well, okay, you'll obviously want this diversity for your own countries as well, then.
Yeah.
Of course, you'll be desperate to go back there and take some black people and some Chinese and loads of white people, obviously, as well. Yeah. But of course they won't. And at that point, it's obvious what their racism is exposed, their anti-white bigotry is exposed. Because the truth is, no Indian wants India to become Africa. No Indian wants India to become the Middle East. No. It's obvious.
Yes. And yet they come and lecture us on just what we have gained by letting in people who are utterly unlike ourselves, who do not want to be like us, who actually despise us. And that is somehow the future and fate of the United States. As you say, they would never accept that for their own country. And when you think about it, good grief. Imagine going to China and saying, not a bad country you have here. You're doing pretty well. But, you know, the trouble with China, too damn many Chinese. You need some diversity. You need a bunch of Pakistanis, and, Mexicans, that'll really ginger up the place. Salvadorans and Haitians. Oh, boy, they really turn the place into a hot. Good grief.
If I said that, I would assume that I'm trying to destroy the Chinese. I would only say that if I wanted to destroy. That's the plan, right?
They'd call the men in the white coats. They'd lock you up. They'd put you in a straitjacket. First of all, they're just so bloody insulting. Some foreigner telling them they got too many Chinese in their country. But that's, in effect, what they're saying to us. Not a bad place, just too many of you white people here. We need to reduce you, just cut you down to size. But that's just par for the course these days for immigrants who show up, especially the well-educated ones. It seems like if they come from the Middle East or they come from Latin America, the more education they have, the more they're exposed to all of this utterly poisonous thinking in American universities, then the more they despise us, the more they think they can get up on their high horse and tell us how we should be American. Just the utter arrogance of it. No, it's breathtaking.
It really is. I'll just continue with the questions because there's several have come in. And again, this is on Entropy, people, so I won't see the questions in the live chat, so please don't post them there. Okay, how much is the problem of whites don't want to see themselves as victims? White SJWs see every failure of non-whites as their fault. Mm-hmm. Blacks have played the victim for so long, they never see themselves as perpetrators. Whites never see themselves as victims.
Well, there is a certain quality about whites that you see whenever there's a national disaster, for example. If there's flooding in Iowa, you don't have whites lining up with outstretched palms waiting for Uncle Sam to bail them out. White people look after themselves. And the idea of being a crybaby and saying, oh, this guy, he was mean to me, which is the way that black people get ahead in life, this is something that's very alien to whites. So it is certainly true that even though white people really are the most clear objects and targets of systemic racism in this country, very few of them will take any kind of victim attitude. I think that's part of our basic nature. There is a kind of heroic nature of white people that refuses to play the victim. And I think that's part of our nature, part of our virtue. But in this game, in this day and age, in which being the victim is how you get ahead, it won't do us any good. But at the same time, if whites were to really start talking about the way in which they get the short end of the stick, they would be considered whiners. They would be kicked even harder. We would be told, well, you're whining? Despite all that white privilege you got, boy, you must be a real loser. You were born with 20 silver spoons in your mouth. You spat them all out. You blew every chance you had. You're even more of a loser than we thought. That is what you would get. So there's really no percentage in being a whiner anyway.
Right. Okay. Someone says, always good to see Uncle Jared. I don't have a question. Merry Christmas.
Oh, well, Merry Christmas to you, Nephew George.
Thank you very much for that super chat. Okay. One wonders if the difference between the 60s and today is not so much that whites are more self-loathing, but that they are more intimidated, demoralized, numb, and atomized now.
Well, those things are all true, but the question is then why? What has changed? And as I say, I just don't have a good answer for this. Again, just to repeat myself, the idea that after the Watts riots, we were going to somehow appease blacks by tearing down statues of Columbus. If somebody proposed that, they'd call for the white courts in the United States. This just would have been insane. Of course, now it's almost taken for granted. They rioted. Not only are we going to give them billions of dollars, we're going to tear down statues of Columbus. What next?
Yes, indeed. And we didn't actually talk about the statues very much because I think that's a truly monstrous and very disturbing thing. I really hate to see like an old church being demolished. You see it all the time in France now. A painting being defaced, a sculpture being smashed. These things really disturb me viscerally. Yes. And it's the same with statues because these are old. I mean, they've been there like on that street corner or wherever it is for decades, a century, more than a century sometimes. Yes. And God knows how many thousands and thousands and thousands of people have seen that statue there. And it represents a continuity with the past and with the future, they would have assumed. Mm-hmm. And now it doesn't. Now it's gone. And many of them have been defaced and, you know, damaged beyond repair. It's hideous. It's really disgusting. It's a terrible impulse. It's like this awful nihilistic revolutionary impulse to just destroy.
I agree. It is absolutely revolting. And you will see war memorials in the United States on November 11th, which used to be Armistice Day, and it's supposed to be the celebration of our foreign wars. You will find graffiti sprayed onto war memorials that say, fuck white people. Yeah. What's this? And we are supposed to say, oh, well, they must have some legitimate reason for this. Or tearing down statues of actual legitimate saints. Junipero Serra, he is a Catholic saint. His statue has been torn down because he allegedly mistreated the Indians in the United States. He built all of these missions in California, but he was yet another white man. And when you think about why must we destroy statues of Columbus, what it's saying is white people coming to North America, this was a catastrophe. We have no right to this place. We should never be here. And so it renders illegitimate the entire project of Western civilization in the Western Hemisphere. That's what it says. Now, of course, if we actually had a right to Europe, well, then maybe we'd go back. But we don't even have a right to Europe. If a Frenchman wants France to stay French, my God, well, he's a Nazi. So,
well, yeah. And the same with South Africans don't have a right to Europe.
That's right.
And I honestly think they should. I think that Britain and the Netherlands should be saying, yes, absolutely, you can move here whenever you want. No questions asked.
I agree. But no, white people, we have no homeland, no place really to call our own.
Well, indeed, I'll take a go at that question that was just asked. Because, well, one wonders if the difference between the 60s and today is that not that whites are more self-loathing, but that they're more intimidated, demoralized, numb, and atomized. I think that's very true. I think the atomization, I think that's partly a result of just modernity and the world that we live in now, post-industrial world, very digital, very online world now. That's part of it. But then other groups aren't. I mean, they suffer from that same thing, and yet it's not making them atomized. So it is specific to white people. And I think that you've just got to acknowledge that our culture, the culture of our own societies or the societies that used to be our own, that very culture has been weaponized against us and subverted and is now a program for intimidating, demoralizing, and atomizing us.
There was a very popular book by Robert Putnam, must have been now 20 years ago, called Bowling Alone. I don't know how well read that was outside of the United States, but it did talk about the disappearance of, well, bowling alone. It's about bowling leagues. There used to be bowling leagues. People would get together and they'd have competition. Now people go bowling alone, something unthinkable. And we had all of these clubs. They were the Lions clubs and the Elks and the Moose and the Shriners and all of these social organizations that people got together. People had block associations, community, churches. Churches were much stronger. All of these things, as you say, they have glimmered away to a quite remarkable degree. And we are a herd animal. We like being in the herd. And once these organically formed herds have been dispersed, we feel much lonelier. But as you say, all of these forces have been hard at work on every other group, but they still have at least maintained a kind of racial solidarity. Even if they don't, if they're not part of a bowling league, they sure do come out for Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter rally.
Well, even when they don't have, when any specific ethnic minority doesn't have gatherings and so on, which are unique to them, but most of them do. But even when they don't have that, they have an awareness of their racial identity. They have a sort of latent solidarity, which at any time can be enacted and become real solidarity. Whereas whites are constantly told, you don't even have an identity. So what is there to have solidarity in? Which again, it's just completely farcical. That gets us into the realms of Cheddar Man and so on, which we talked about last.
Well, no, it's now dogma that there can be no such thing as a positive white identity. Whiteness is by its very definition something that is negative and oppressive. And for a white person to think of himself as white must be, if one thinks in those terms at all, it must be an attempt to rid ourselves of our whiteness, because there is nothing to whiteness other than supremacy, exploitation, and cruelty to others.
I would just assume that is self-evidently a genocidal sentiment, and I would just assume, again, anyone who said it was trying to destroy my race. I mean, it's just obvious. I think everyone should develop that attitude, that is just an obviously hateful thing to say, and it can only lead to one thing, which is the disenfranchisement of whites and then their eventual extinction. Yes. It's very obvious. Okay, so, okay, Jared, the top high school, Thomas Jefferson High School, is now 80% Asian and only 17% white. Were you aware of this, and will the media cover this up? This is like the Harvard of high schools.
Ah, well, I happen to live very close to Thomas Jefferson High School. And up until this year, it accepted students strictly on the basis of a very, very rigorous examination. And as it happens, I have a close relationship with a woman who teaches private tutoring sessions for people who want to score better on the SAT or the ACT or on the Thomas Jefferson preparatory test. And she's told me something very interesting, that almost all of her clients are Asians, first of all. The Asian children are generally grinds, but they work very hard at trying to master any kind of special angle they have to do well on the test. I think on average, East Asians are smarter than whites. And certainly when they are adolescents, they tend to be much more diligent about doing what they're told. They're more conformist. They're more willing to sit still, work hard, do well on these examinations. Now, the fact that it's overwhelmingly Asian, that's not a problem as far as the authorities are concerned. The problem, of course, is there are practically no blacks or Hispanics. And they have been trying for years to give them special tutoring sessions, all to no avail. They're just a handful of our current pets who are actually there. And so what they're going to do, they're going to, like they're doing all across the country, they're going to modify the admissions process to include an element of chance, a sort of lottery. Here you have a school that used to be selecting its students strictly on the basis of a very, very rigorous winnowing process. No. Can't have that, because that's obviously unfair, because blacks and Hispanics don't succeed. So this is all going to be changed. And naturally, the people who put up the biggest fight against this were the Asians, because they have a sense of group solidarity. They realize that this change is going to mean fewer Asians. And so they demonstrated, they marched in front of the school board, all to no avail, because these days, Black Lives Matter, folks.
And wasn't there something recently, very recently, where East Asians are no longer considered people of color?
There was a school district that floated this idea. I don't think it makes much difference, really, because Asians, on the one hand, when there aren't loads and loads of them, they can still benefit from diversity privileges, and no one ever discriminates against them. Now, there have been lawsuits at Harvard and Yale in which Asians, if they were left to their own devices, if you went strictly on test scores, they would be even more on those campuses than there are today. Interestingly enough, the way Harvard has explained its numerous clauses on Asians has to do with what they call leadership qualities. Now, it's all very well to talk about leadership, but when I was living in New York City, at one time, I used to interview people who were applying to go to my university, which is Yale. And I did notice that all of the Asians who wanted to go, they were very hardworking, but they all had personalities that were about as exciting as cardboard. And I got to the point when I would ask them, tell me something that you're passionate about. This would stun them. They had a hard time telling me something they were passionate about. And there were very few of them that I thought really were dynamic, creative. They were ambitious in the sense they wanted to go to an Ivy League university. They wanted to do well. They wanted to make a lot of money. But they just had this kind of grind attitude. And there was a real flavor about that. And I'm sure that even at Harvard or at Thomas Jefferson, this high school that is perhaps the best in the country, at least academically, on the one hand, yes, they want people who can do very well on these objective examinations. On the other hand, they don't want people who are, at some level, boring. They don't want them to be such huge numbers. I think that's one of the reasons why Harvard does not admit strictly on the basis of merit. That's one of the reasons. And of course, they feel as though they got to have a proper number of blacks and Hispanics and American Indians and whoever the latest pets are.
Right. Okay. I would. It seems to me that I'm not saying that this has happened already. I'm just saying I could imagine it being plausible that at some point East Asians will be disqualified from diversity points and regarded as kind of honorary whites.
Well,
because they are not a group that can be. I don't know that it's too glaring. If they are going to keep doing well in our societies, then that makes it too glaring that we are being treated unfairly.
Well, think of it this way: all of the big tech companies in Silicon Valley are constantly being lacerated for lack of diversity. Well, if Asians count for diversity, they're diverse as heck. Asians are vastly overrepresented, certainly in all of the tech jobs. And whites, by that standard, are underrepresented compared to their numbers in the population. But you can be full of Asians, but no, you're right. That doesn't count for diversity. What really counts for diversity is something that is all black. Professional basketball in the United States, overwhelmingly black. I think it's about 85% of the players are black. That is praised as being a model for diversity. So as some wag once pointed out, diversity just means fewer white people. Diversity means, but as you say, Asians sort of don't count in that game. So that if you have a place like TJ, Thomas Jefferson, where it's 80-85% Asian, that's not diverse. Even though diversity usually means fewer whites, because you don't have enough Eskimos and American Indians and one-legged black lesbians and all the other people who really count for diversity.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's going to go that way. Okay, now here are two questions which we can end with. Given that we have become victims of our own success and are rapidly importing our own Darwinian reset that threatens our existence, what is the path forward? And then the other question is, in one generation, we'll be a minority in America, as mm-hmm. will our children. What do we instill into our children? How do we orient them to deal with the new context that we're all moving into?
Well, what we must do is what you and I both do, and that is to try to reach white people, educate white people, shake them out of this utterly soporific, walking off the edge of the cliff state of sleepwalking that so many of our brothers and sisters are in. And I believe that because what you and I say is true, what we say is morally unimpeachable, and it is in full conformity with everything we know about history, human nature, psychology, and what is perfectly normal and natural. When people are made aware of our ideas, they find them often irresistible. That's, of course, why people are trying so hard to make it impossible to hear you and me and the things that we say. So we have to try, redouble our efforts to fight through the censorship and reach other whites so that they understand what's happening. Now, what can we do as a practical matter? That, of course, is a very difficult thing. We have so many built-in headwinds. I remember about 20 years ago, a big debate in the pages of American Renaissance magazine, when it was a paper magazine, whether our goal should be to retake all of the United States, or would we be satisfied with some sort of Balkanization, division of territory? And at that time, 20 years ago, the idea of somehow giving up even a part of the United States was anathema to many people. These days, I suspect that if you were to draw a line right down the middle of the United States and white people were to say to all the non-whites, okay, you pick one half, we'll take the other half, your choice. That would be a division of the spoils that many white people would accept, because if things continue as they are, as this person points out, we will become a minority, and not just a minority, but increasingly hated and despised minority. Just like everything that ever goes wrong in South Africa today is a legacy of apartheid, even if it's something that obviously blacks have brought on themselves, like the inability to run a power plant. That's a legacy of apartheid. So we will be hated long after we are gone if it comes to that. So to me, what we have to think in terms of, at least in North America, is building communities of our own. And that means coalescing in places where we can perhaps take over the school district. Start small. I mean, it sounds almost defeated, but the idea of taking back America in any national scale, I just do not see the combination of political forces that would enable that to take place. I'm sorry, this is the nation that my people have lived in for 350 years, but I don't think we can take it back. We have to salvage what bits of wreckage of our society in small corners where we can. Now, there are many different ideas, and this is an increasingly popular idea of building explicitly white communities. But I believe that that is the direction which we'll have to go, with the hope that eventually we can expand, perhaps to county and even the state level, to find some area which is unequivocally ours.
Okay, I didn't realize you were about to stop speaking there. You think that we should retreat to safe havens and then expand outwards from there? That in summary.
If we remain atomized as we are and with no voice in politics, if we do nothing, we will simply be washed away, shoved aside, elbowed out of this land of our ancestors. I just see no other alternative. Now, in Europe, there are other choices. Certainly in Eastern Europe, things are much healthier there. But any 16-year-old or younger white person is already a minority in this country. You could stop immigration tomorrow, and the future of the United States is already majority non-white. We are going to be outbred, outvoted. I can imagine laws being passed that punish us simply because of our race. I think the only solution for survival as a people is to have enclaves of some kind. If we start building them now, maybe some of them will be large enough to be really on a national scale by European standards.
All right. This is probably something that we'll talk about in years to come, I imagine, as things develop. It wouldn't surprise me at all if that is the way forward for America. All right. Well, thank you very much. I don't think there are any more super chats, so we can just leave it at that. So, Jared Taylor, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2020. Is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
I perhaps ended on what may have seemed like a pessimistic note. I do not wish to leave your listeners or viewers feeling pessimistic. I think that it is very clear that there are more white people waking up all the time. It's really a matter of numbers. If enough people see the world as you and I do, things will change, and things will change in ways that we cannot even anticipate or imagine. We are more in the education stage rather than the political stage. But once education succeeds, then politics, then power arrangements begin to change, and people whose names we don't even know will emerge, who will be part of a new consciousness of whites. I am very optimistic in that respect. There's still 150 million white people in this country. We're not going to disappear. We can save something of our heritage and civilization. And so on that note, so long as we do our duty, and as Robert E. Lee said, duty is the most beautiful word in the English language. So long as we do our duty, we have every reason to remain optimistic.
All right. Thank you very much, Jared Taylor, for appearing in Millennial 2020. That's been a lovely stream and very informative for many people, I think. Just before I finish, I'll say that tomorrow I have five streams. The first is with John Waters. He's the surprise guest, an Irish commentator and academic and writer. Then Duke of Durham. Then American Zarathustra. Then E. Michael Jones. And then Endeavour. So that's five streams tomorrow. So that'll be a very busy evening. And someone did ask, Jared, about your debate with E. Michael Jones. It's going to be my first time talking to him ever, by the way. I know that you had a debate that was going to happen.
Yes.
Someone was asking about that.
It was to be in Zagreb, but like so many world-famous international events, it was cancelled by the virus, just like the Tokyo Olympics. So, no, we do hope to have that debate sometime in the future. but it's not yet been scheduled. But I look forward to that very much.
Oh, I think many people are looking forward to that. All right. Thank you very much, Jared Taylor. And I hope to see you again next year. And in the meantime, thank you everyone for watching tonight. And I will see you tomorrow night for the eighth night of Millennial 2020. Bye for now.